According to the census last year, the estimate actually, there were about 7.53 billion people on this planet in 2017. Expect to be about 7.7 billion at the end of this year. But the vast majority, maybe minus some sociopaths, the vast majority of those that were born with a desire for recognition from other human beings. We have a natural bent from the first breath that we take, so to speak, a natural bent to be noticed or recognized or appreciated by others. Now, we'll seek that in a good way or sometimes even in a bad way if we can't get it any other way. I mean, kids will act out just to get their parents' attention if they can't seem to get it any other way. And quite frankly, it's disturbing as it is. Everybody here, well, maybe not everybody, but most people here at least, they hear that ding on your cell phone and that like you just got on whatever you posted or an emoji or a share on Facebook. It's like the social media equivalent of an energy drink. They're actually finding out that every time that phone dings, we get a little mini shot of dopamine into our brain, seriously do, that makes us crave more. And so the more likes you get, the better you feel. There's a certain point where you're actually discouraged that you only got 3 likes on a post, but if you got 55 likes on a post, that's a great day, and you feel really good. I'm not sure I get this, but that's the way it is. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with desiring recognition. It secures us a place at some level in society. No one craves being the outcast from the crowd. It motivates us to continue towards a goal like graduation. We go forward at graduation when our cap and gown, our family cheers and yells and shouts and throws things from the audience, and it makes us feel better. And we've got some recognition for 12 years of schooling or graduation from college or a higher degree. It supplies us with some sense of value in life. Just when my boys would cut the grass when they were young, the first thing they'd want to do when they were done was come and get me to say, how does it look? And usually with the one son, I won't mention any names. It was a naughty list of things he had to finish on that yard before he was going to get the pat on the back. It supplies us with some sense of value in life to have some recognition. Even a small circle of friends that we have is a circle that we're recognized in. It feels good to be appreciated. Recognition can indeed be healthy as long as it doesn't become pride. Pride desires all the credit for what it's being recognized for itself. Pride wants to displace the credit that's actually due to its source, which is our Creator. Paul, as we're closing down on the book of Philippians, I think I have one more week next week to finish out this epistle. But Paul rightly desires to acknowledge the sacrificial ministry of giving in the church body in the city of Philippi. And he desires to do so without claiming one iota of credit that belongs to God. So let's go to Philippians. We're going to pick up in verse 10 again, so we're reading with some context. And we're going to read through verse 17. But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at the last your care of me has flourished again, wherein you were also careful, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. I know both how to be abased and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Notwithstanding, you have well done that you did communicate with my affliction. Now you Philippians know also that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, no church communicated with me as concerning giving and receiving, but only you. For even in Thessalonica, you sent once and again unto my necessity, not because I desired a gift, but I desired fruit that may abound to your account. But I have all and abound. I am full, having received of Epaphroditus the things which were sent from you, an odor of a sweet smell, a sacrifice acceptable, well-pleasing to God. I read 18. That's where we're going to come back to next week. But in verses 11 through 13, which we looked at last week, Paul notes that he had to learn in whatsoever state he was in therewith to be content. The context means that over time, with both education and experience, he had come to trust God alone to supply all of his needs. That faith in God's providence, whatever that providence was in his life, was sufficient for him to be content. But to acknowledge the sufficiency of the Creator in supplying must also include acknowledging the means that he uses to do so. And while the Lord has all of the options at his disposal to act with, we can go back to Elijah by the brook. God brought him to a cave. There were no other human beings there. There was water in the brook to drink during the famine. And God sent ravens his way to feed him every day, bringing food for him. In Isaiah 46, it says that he not only calls a man to a far country, but sometimes even a ravenous bird to a feast. God has all of the options at his disposal. But he most often uses people to affect his means, just like those in Philippi. And in verse 14, Paul recognizes the body in Philippi as the means chosen by God to supply his needs, commending them as having well done, he says, in their service. Well done, the word kalos speaks of something done with sound and virtuous character. Now, there's a lot of things we can do in life that are, in the end, good things. I used to look at when the Jerry Lewis telethon used to be on, and some company wanted PR, basically. They would step on stage and give $200,000 to that charity. Now, that was a good thing, right? Because the charity got the money and it was used to help fight the disease. But I would question their motives in the giving of it. But commending something someone does as being well done is saying it was done for the right reasons. It was done with sound and virtuous character. It's the same word that's used in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verses 4, 12, and 13, and in chapter 5, verse 17, to speak about the right kind of character that's required of those who would become pastors and deacons. In other words, you need to become a pastor or a deacon for the right reasons, and it needs to be done with sound character. This was exhibited by Philippi, who shared with Paul's affliction, who shared with Paul's needs by giving to him, it says in 2 Corinthians 8, 2-3, listen to this, we read it last week, I'll read it to you again, by giving to him liberally with joy out of their deep poverty beyond their ability and while under persecution. This is how they gave to the church in Jerusalem, who was not as poor as they were, and yet they gave, and then it says they gave even above what they could give by taking from themselves and giving to the church there. And this they did also for the Apostle Paul. Now, no sin is committed when we note the sacrifices of others. None whatsoever. In fact, when we acknowledge something that someone's done that is done for the right reason, that is good, there's nothing sinful about that at all. As there is no sin in the showing of gratitude. Listen, no true sacrifice, no sacrifice that's given that's done rightfully is done with pride. Frauds do that. But true, honorable, sound sacrifice is never done in a prideful manner. Verse 15, Paul says that giving in Philippi was their M.O. early on. He said by the time the city, he came there first, crossed into Macedonia, went to Philippi first, stayed to establish the church. And by the time he left the body in that city on their own, they were already the only church in Macedonia that was committed, that made an actual commitment as a church body to the systematic fellowship of giving to the needs of Paul. This may be something like, not exactly like, in any shape or form, modern missions giving. In other words, they determined in their heart to give to Paul's needs on a regular and somewhat consistent basis. They didn't give one time and later on down the road say, hey, you remember Paul? He was here, started the church. Maybe he has some needs. Let's do that again. They committed that as long as they were aware of his needs and as long as they had the means of getting the giving to him, that they would continue to meet his needs. Now, there did come a time when that ended for a while. They lost contact, I believe, with him on the missions road. But as soon as they came back in contact with him again, the giving again began. Now, it is believed, verse 16, that the giving of Philippi allowed Paul to minister in Thessalonica without being a burden on the establishment of the new body there or needing to find work for himself. When it says in 16, for even in Thessalonica, you sent once again unto my necessity. He's not saying that he was in Thessalonica and that church there did nothing while I was there. He's saying that's a brand new body and there would have been two ways of me being taken care of while I was there or having my needs met. One would have been a burden upon a very small and very young church, or I would have had to apply my trade of being a tent maker. And because of the giving and the poor church in Philippi, Paul was able to give all of his attention and to the needs of the growth of the body in that city. And he was grateful and blessed for that. Verse 17, he says, not out of some selfish desire to have my own needs met. So not because I desired a gift, but I desired that fruit may abound to your account, primarily because of his shepherd's heart, primarily because he desired to see them grow by learning to do those things which God has called us to do and being obedient to the calling of God, even when it kind of swims upstream, doesn't it, from what we would think. You've got the poorest church in the region. What we talked a couple of weeks ago, they had to actually talk the emissaries into taking those gifts and givings to Paul, because you're taking from the poorest people to give the people that have maybe a little bit more than they have. And Paul says, no, in the giving there are fruits that abound to your account. They could see the evidence of Christ working in their lives. And that abounds in and is registered in the record that's kept by God of the deeds that we do. Fruit is the combination of godly character, Galatians 5, and godly deeds. We will never have godly character and no godly deeds. One will absolutely lead to the other. And if you're just doing deeds without godly character, they're not godly deeds. They're just deeds. CG and I talked this morning because of a post that was on and said, you know, again, if our country, if this nation, our people, give $8 million to Puerto Rico to help with the destruction that's there, that's a good thing. But it's a temporal thing. It has no eternal value. Only those things that we do for the Lord. Now, could you give goods and stuff to Puerto Rico as you are moved by the Lord to do so? And could that be a godly deed? Of course it can. But I'm saying that not everything that we do, not even in the church, can be considered a godly deed, but if you have godly character, the deeds will follow. These are the ones that are produced inside first in us. They change us, who we are, and then they blossom outwardly. Ephesians 5, we're going to turn to some quick verses. I'm not going to spend much time there. Ephesians 5, verse 9 and 10. We read this. For the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness and righteousness and truth, proving what is acceptable unto the Lord. The fruit of the Spirit, those fruits that we do that have godly value, eternal value, are found in all goodness and righteousness and truth. And they prove what is the acceptable will of the Lord. James chapter 3, verses 17 and 18. We read that the wisdom that is from above, that wisdom that comes from above down to man, is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy, and the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. And back in Philippians in chapter 1, verses 8 through 11, we read this. For God is my record, how greatly I longed after you all in the bowels of Jesus Christ, speaking to this very church in Philippi. And this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in all judgment, right discernment, that you may approve things that are excellent, that you may be sincere and without offense till the day of Christ, being filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are by Jesus Christ unto the glory and praise of God. Now, giving may be the most difficult area to freely and joyfully bear fruit in. The love of money is the root of all evil. It's not having money. But the love of money, 1 Timothy 6:10, is evil because it becomes the idol that we worship or trust in place of God. We begin to trust what we have and want to hang on to that. But giving requires that we trust Him for our living, that there's nothing in our hands that we love so much that we won't loosen our grip on it should God move us to give it away. That's exactly the way it was in Philippi, and none of us here are in the position financially that Philippi was in. It's no small thing, though, to let go of what we perceive we need to survive. It's an understandable dilemma, isn't it, sometimes, that only faith can actually overcome. I want to read again some verses for you, most of them in Proverbs. Proverbs 11, 24 and 25. And then I'll move quickly through these. I just want to make the point, if I can here. It says, there is that person that scatters and yet increases, that person that gives everything away and yet still gets more. And there is that person that withholds more than he needs to, but it tends in the end to become poverty. So he says, people give away and they increase, and some people hang on to things and they lose everything. 25, the liberal soul shall be made fat, and he that waters shall be watered also himself. It's a plea to give. Proverbs 19, verse 17. It says, he that has pity upon the poor lends unto the Lord. Not the Lord has need. It's saying that it's credited with him. And that which he has given, will he pay him again. You can't outgive the Lord. Proverbs 22, verse 9. He that has a bountiful eye, a giving eye, shall be blessed, for he gives of his bread to the poor. Luke, the Gospel of Luke, chapter 6, and the words of Jesus, so these are all the words of Jesus actually, but verse 38 says, give, and it shall be given unto you, good measure, pressed down and shaken together and running over shall men give into your bosom. For with the same measure that you meet withal shall it be measured to you again. And finally, in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, so turn there. I'm going to run through these verses very quickly following the reading, starting in verse 6. He says, "But this I say, he which sows sparingly shall also reap sparingly, and he which sows bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Every man, according as he has purposed in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound towards you, that you, always having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work. As it is written, he has dispersed abroad, he has given to the poor, his righteousness remains forever. Now he that ministers seed to the sower, ministers bread for your food, and multiplies your seed sown, and increases the fruit of your righteousness, that's God, being enriched in everything to all bountifulness, which causes us thanksgiving to God. For the administration, the giving of this service, not only supplies the needs of the saints, but is abundant also by many thanksgivings by them unto God. While by the experiment of this ministration, they glorify God for your professed subjection unto the gospel of Christ and for your liberal distribution unto them and unto all men. And by their prayer for you, which long after you for the exceeding grace of God in you, thanks be unto God for his unspeakable gift." Now, verse 6 is, by the way, it's an agricultural metaphor that promotes liberal giving. That's all it does. It's used by some charlatans from the pulpits around the country, some of the charismatic and Pentecostal guys especially, that use it as a principle to get more wealth. What do they say to you? They say, if you give us $100, God will give you $1,000. To which I reply, then why don't you give me $100 and let God give you $1,000, if that's really the way it works. Because that's what you're doing. You're trying to steal from people by misusing this metaphor. But verse 7 tells us that giving is a hard issue. It's not a binding law, but it's something that should be done with a lot of joy and not as a burden. You shouldn't come here with trying to pry your fingers loose from the money you're throwing into the offering basket. If that's the case, hang on to it. Verse 8, it says, "The bounty that we get from giving is abounding grace. It's not riches, more riches for us to hoard, so that we may continue to abound in every good work, not just in the work of giving." Verse 9, it's the example that Jesus gave to us. Verse 10, giving increases our ability to give more, because we can't outgive God, and it's God who gives us what we need, and only he can really increase our having in order to produce more fruit in us in the giving. Verse 11, which causes us to be thankful. When we experience the work of God in us, when we experience him gracing us for the giving, then it moves us to be thankful. Verse 12, which overflows in thankfulness to those that are blessed by the giving. Verse 13, God is then glorified, the gospel is preached, and needs are met. All the right things are done. Verse 14, others begin to pray for us because of God's grace in us. It becomes a working witness. Verse 15, all due to God and the gifts that he gives to us. In his final words to the Ephesian elders in Acts chapter 20, before Paul departs for Rome, to where he's going to have an audience with Caesar, which is going to end in his arrest, his imprisonment, and eventually his execution, his beheading. He closes his counsel to the elders in Ephesus with these words out of Acts 20 and verse 32 through 36. "And now, brethren," he says, "I commend you to God and to the word of his grace, which is able to build you up and to give you an inheritance among all them which are sanctified." That inheritance is in heaven. It's not here. He says, "I've coveted no man's silver or gold or apparel." I didn't make myself rich off of anybody. hands have ministered unto my necessities and to them that were with me. He says, I worked as a tent maker and even supplied my own needs and the needs of others. 35, I've showed you all things, how that so laboring you ought to support the weak and to remember the words of the Lord Jesus, how he said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. And when he had thus spoken, he kneeled down and prayed with them all, and they all wept sore and fell on Paul's neck and kissed him. Prior to his conversion, Paul, then a man named Saul, was all about himself and all about being successful in life. He was first in his class. It said he was head and shoulders in education and achievement above all of his peers. He was ambitious and aggressive and living for the here and now. What can I do to further my career? But after the Damascus Road experience, he set his affections on things above, not on things on the earth, where Christ sits on the right hand of his Father. Paul Tripp, in the videos that we see every few weeks on Wednesdays, refers to this as being forever minded. Some people have said we're so earthly minded, we're no heavenly good, and that's basically part of that saying of being forever minded, of seeing this temporal life in the light of the eternity that follows. This isn't all there is. This is just a barely a blip. It's actually a blip that probably wouldn't even show up at all on the scale of eternity. God puts us here for a time. Just a time. That time, as we get older, seems to go awfully fast. I think it's on greased rails right now. Listen, what we do here with what God has given to us is important beyond ourselves, and it's important beyond this time in which we live. It can have temporal value, but it's no good without eternal value as well. So that the recognition for whatever we do here, whatever that might be, ultimately returns to God's glory, without whom we couldn't do anything of lasting value at all. We are instruments in God's hand to use as he intends. Isaiah 10:15. My brother brought it up and read it on Wednesday night when we were in study. One of my favorite verses, I was glad he brought it up. Isaiah 10:15. Listen to this. Shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shakes it, as if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up, or as if the staff should lift up itself as if it were no wood? In other words, an instrument, which is what we are, can do nothing without the one who holds it. I can go someplace and look at an axe. In fact, I've seen one on TV in a show Carol Jean and I watched not long ago. It was a beautiful, wonderfully carved handle from one end to the other, intricately carved handle, a beautiful axe head done with scrolling and stuff etched into the metal and so forth. And it sits on display in a museum someplace for the craftsmanship, which means it's absolutely worthless beyond seeing the craftsmanship. I can enjoy the fact that someone can do that work, but that axe was created to chop things down. And it's not doing a dog thing in that museum. I like cars. I like the Velocity Channel, now Motor Trend Channel. I watch them take these, they bring in these rusted pieces of junk and virtually in baskets and end up creating some beautiful car out of it that's gorgeous. And then I think, what would I do if I had that car? I'd be afraid to drive it anyplace. In fact, when they take it out on a test run, I think it's getting stones thrown up off the road and dirt and dust. And so I'm thinking, what good would it do me to have that car? I walk out in the garage, go, they have guys that come in. They have guys that come in and they say, how many times have you driven this car since we did it for you? Which is like 5 or 6 years ago. About 3. But it makes me nervous to put it on the road. All that labor for nothing. If you're not going to use it or get some joy out of it. Listen, we're just axes. We may be the best axe God ever made, but we can just lay there in a display case doing nothing unless he picks us up and swings us. We can't boast against the one who holds us. The axe didn't cut a tree down. The one who swings it did. We're just instrument in his hands. Now, verse 18 in Philippians, which we're not going to go to, speaks of the giving of Philippi, and it describes it as an odor of a sweet smell, a sacrifice acceptable and well-pleasing to God. So Paul goes in and he commends Philippi on their giving. Did he create pride in the city of Philippi? I don't think so, because that's not where their hearts were. The only reason that Paul could commend them was because he was convinced that there wasn't a swelling, prideful heart in the city. Because he was convinced that their giving was sound and of good character. So he goes in and he commends them, but he also wants to make sure that they understand, which they do, and now us, that we understand that they couldn't give anything at all, unless the Lord so blessed them to be able to do so. And that means that even when they gave more than they actually had, they still never went without. Like the widow of Zarephath, who took the last bit of meal and oil out of her barrel to make one more loaf of bread, and yet every time she stuck her hand in, there was more oil and more meal. God kept supplying the need. You cannot outgive the Lord. So what does it mean? What makes something that we do, an odor of a sweet smell and a sacrifice acceptable and well-pleasing to God? And that's what we're going to look at next week. That statement is attached to the sacrificial system. And so there's significant meaning in that verse. That's where we're going to go next week. We're going to end here. So next week, Lord willing, will be our final message out of Philippians. Now you can pray for me for where I end up going next, because I really don't know where that's going to be. So keep me in prayer if you would. But over this week, I want you to take the time to consider exactly what that verse means in verse 18. Maybe you can come here next Sunday and teach me something I've missed in the development of that message. But think about that this week. What does it mean that what we do becomes an odor of sweet smell and a sacrifice acceptable and well-pleasing to God? That's your homework for the week. Go home and do that, starting right now. Amen? All right, today is, I'm going to close with prayer, but today is communion service. If you're visiting today and you have confidence in your